You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Jobs, reshoring manufacturing, using the pandemic as a reason to kind of reset 40 years of bad economic ideology. We've got some great opportunities and some good announcements here recently. Quite frankly, I'm thrilled by the fact that on Friday last week, you had Intel saying, hey, we're going to invest some money in Central Ohio, $20 billion they're talking about, going to create tens of thousands of jobs. You see today the news that General Motors is going to be investing in Michigan. A number of plants there. They're going to spend $7 billion on four plants. They're going to create some 4,000 jobs. And as they said, they're going to make Michigan the hub of electric vehicle development and manufacturing. Because understand where their production is, where they're already at. This is a big deal. It's kind of a big deal. And we've been seeing a whole bunch of investment in this new technology. We're seeing battery plants all over the place that are popping up. We're seeing manufacturing come back. And what's interesting, if you listen to some in the corporate-controlled media, it's because of, all of the slush funds that you see in Republican states like Ohio. And partially it is because we've got to buy our way back into this. But it's about the Biden administration saying, we're going to reshore this stuff. We're going to... going to put our money where our mouth is. We're going to rebuild manufacturing. And look, I'll start right from the beginning with this. No one hates the idea of giving corporate America more money than I do. Nobody likes the fact that we're going to have to buy back our manufacturing prowess. Nobody likes the idea less than I do that the same people who abandoned our country for foreign cheap labor and lax environmental regulations are now being wooed back with our tax dollars. But here's the reality. We have to do something to reshore those jobs. And more importantly, I think what all of us are coming around to, or at least I hope all of us are coming around to the reality that this pandemic has kind of highlighted some of our deficiencies, some of our abilities to ramp up productions in the hour of need. And if you go back, you learn a little bit about the history of World War II. One of the reasons that we were able to do as well as we did is because we had the ability on the home front to have a manufacturing base, to turn factories, car factories into war production. In fact, I think of the one where I grew up in Cleveland where my grandparents worked. My grandfather worked in a tank plant when he got back from the war. This was This is what we were able to do. Now you look at the places where we had manufacturing. And again, you know, as someone who grew up in a Rust Belt city, like Cleveland was, I remember those manufacturing jobs. I remember the steel mills. And look, the air quality wasn't great, and we can deal with that. We can fix that stuff. The jobs were there. The prosperity was there. The opportunities were there. We need to claim that back. But more importantly, the national security was there. The fact that in the moments of our moments of need, we could just ramp up production. Now you go back to some of those places where, you know, 30 years ago, those were good family sustaining wage jobs. Now they're just hollowed out shells of empty buildings and bricks falling down. And I always point out the book that Michael Moore put out. He asked the question. He had a picture of what the Oklahoma City bombing building and one of the GM factories in Flint, Michigan. And he put them side by side and you couldn't tell the difference. And he goes, which one's terrorism? And that's one of the really important questions when we look at what happened to our manufacturing base. Because the results are the same. The factories are gone, the jobs are gone, and the problems come. So am I happy to see finally, you know, these companies are reinvesting in this country? Yes. Am I going to give them too much credit? No, not too much. Because ultimately, this is about the pot. This is about the giant pot of money that the state's handing out in tax abatements and the money that the federal government's going to hand out in guaranteeing that they don't go bankrupt. So, you know, ultimately, they're making out like bandits, and it's going to help us. So, look, I want to be on board. I want to be happy, and I think we should be, but not too much. Now, bringing back those jobs, bringing back the capacity to build stuff, and I always point to there's this bridge in Trenton, New Jersey that I've gone over a number of times. And on the side of it in lights, it says, you know, Trenton makes the world takes. That used to be true. Not so much anymore. So trying to revive that, trying to make sure that that is the direction we go, I'm all in favor of it. Making, you know, cities like, you know, Cleveland and Chicago and Minneapolis and, you know, in Milwaukee and, you know, across the Midwest and across the manufacturing belt of this country, reviving those areas, creating the good jobs, not just with Intel or GM, but all the hundreds and thousands of feeder jobs into those plants. You know, I was talking with someone today and said, you know, when Intel builds that plant in Columbus, there are going to be a ton of industry propping up around it, a ton of opportunity for people in Ohio to build and start businesses. Having Ohio State right there, you're going to have, you know, an intellectual, a knowledge base that, well, you know, you can't just get, that you build. And it makes sense. So as I'm looking at this, I'm going, you know, look, there's a lot of opportunity here. There's a lot of chance to undo some of the damage of the last 40 years. Because if you look at what we did, we gave away the golden goose. Not only did we give the golden goose away, we gave the eggs too. Because at the same time where we were allowing corporate America to move jobs overseas and giving them tax breaks to do it, we were also lowering their income tax rates and lowering the state tax. And we're lowering every tax rate to go, well, no, please, oh, please stay. Quite an abusive relationship. And this is kind of a moment where I love the fact that Biden is saying, look, we're going to put muscle into this. And we're going to use the power of the federal government to ensure that jobs are here. We're going to use the power of the federal government to ensure that those jobs are decent jobs, which is why in the Build Back Better plan, you know, there was that incentive to buy an electric vehicle made by a union company. Because we know those jobs pay a good wage. We know they have retirement security, health security. We know they're safe jobs. We know that the workers have a voice on the job. We know it's a good quality product. So we want to promote that. And I'm all in favor of it. I think it's something we should be pushing forward to. And look, it's kind of a restart, a reset of the way things that, well, I was told it was supposed to be. You know, this idea that work, you know, Ronald Reagan used to say it all the time. You know, the best anti-poverty program is a job. and I've amended it to being the best anti-poverty program, is a union job with reasonable wages, with health care, with retirement, with, you know, vacation, family leave, things that people need. This is about rebuilding what our economy is going to be. And again, the conversations we've had here on this program over the years keep going back to, you know, what kind of an economy do we want to have? Are we happy with the way things have gone the last 40 years where government goes, you know, hey, laissez-faire, you know, whatever the billionaires want, they're going to give them wherever they want to go, open borders, we're going to have trade all over the place, and the trade is going to be, we're going to get cheap stuff from China and elsewhere, and we're going to have to trade our jobs and our prosperity for it. That's what's happened to the working class of this country. And until we wake up to that reality, that it ain't so cheap if you're not building it. If you don't have a job, it doesn't matter how cheap it is. If you can't afford it, you can't afford it. And this is what we've done over the years. And as I've said a number of times, when I grew up as a kid, all of the toys, all of the bikes, all of the things that we consumed were made domestically. Were made by neighbors. Were made by people here supporting their families. And what happened? Well, we had these smart people, the smart folks, the geniuses who went to them Ivy League their schools and that Chicago School of Economics. And they're going to tell us, no, we've got a better way. We're going to get rid of all those dirty jobs. We're going to all have to do service sector jobs. We're going to have an economy based on you wash my windows and I'll shovel your snow, or, you know, I'll cut your hair and you watch my kids. That's going to be our economy. No longer are we going to take the lumber that we get in the upper Midwest or in the upper Northwest. No longer are we going to take that and create furniture in North Carolina. No longer are we going to create goods that we need. We're going to let somebody else do that. We're going to export raw materials and import finished goods, which is, by definition, almost the definition of a third world country, because it's what we were doing. This, to me, is an opportunity. This, to me, is kind of that reset going, you know what? We tried all that. We tried the supply-side voodoo Reaganomics. We tried the neoliberal trade policies. We tried all this stuff. Now is kind of, I'm really hoping, because inequality has never been worse than it is right now. The gap between the haves and the have-nots is enormous. And the amount that the haves have, mind-blowing. This could be an opportunity to write our tax code. This could be an opportunity to write our trade code. This could be a great opportunity to reinvest in the things that we need. And guess what? Give people the dignity and respect of work that is rewarded. So maybe I'm putting too much into this, and I'd love to hear people's thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. But this is an opportunity, I think, to move in a direction that's going to help us, I don't know, leave our kids something better. Now, it's not going to happen right away. It's going to be painful over the next couple of years because understand, for the last 20 years, we've allowed China to do whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want, just as long as they keep feeding our addiction to cheap garbage. We get the cheap stuff. The CEOs get their CEO heroin of cheap labor and lax environmental regulations. And let's not forget the subsidies from the Chinese government. They got hooked on it, man. Hooked. In fact, we all got hooked on it. Until you realize the reality is what we gave away was the American dream. What we gave away was what generations handed down to the next generation. Opportunity to do better than they did. And look, this next generation coming up, you know, all of the indicators are pointing they're not going to do better than their parents unless we make radical changes. Unless we start thinking long term. And this is going to take some doing. This is going to take some doing from people who, quite frankly, don't want to see Joe Biden succeed. There is an opportunity here for this administration to do what needs to be done. Now, do I think he's going to go far enough? No, I don't think Joe Biden is as much as Fox News wants to tell us. He's the most leftist president ever in the history of ever. Because we hear that all the time, don't we? Bill Clinton when I was younger, and he was in office, the most leftist president ever. And I remember going, I don't think you know what leftist is. Same thing with Barack Obama, who said, understand, Barack Obama himself said he would have been an Eisenhower Republican. But they painted him as the most fancy pants, latte drinking, Volvo driving liberal to ever put on a pair of loafers. And he wasn't. He wasn't anything close. So, and Biden isn't close. But the one thing Biden does understand is working class values. The one thing Biden does understand is that, you know, those of us who grew up believing that if you work hard and you play by the rules, that you should get ahead. That kind of stuff. And that's why I'll tell you, I'm thrilled that Joe Biden is president right now. Also, this happened. I like Joe Biden as a person. I've met him a number of times. I've interviewed him. He is a great guy. He's somebody who you sit down and you talk with him. He's like anybody else you'll ever meet. If I wanted to have a beer with somebody, he would be on that list. Not that I'm going down that path, but he is that kind of a decent guy. But he got himself into a little twist. You may remember he did in fact call Peter Ducey Ducey did shout out a moronic question, but he did in fact react to Ducey's moronic question of, do you think inflation is a political liability ahead of the midterms? I mean, that's a really dumb question. And he did answer it with a sarcastic, what a great asset, more inflation. What a stupid SOB. He did do that. And, yeah, I think really so. The thing I respect about Biden is, you know what, he got it out. About an hour later, he called Peter Ducey and he apologized. Probably shouldn't have done it, you know, whatever that conversation was. What I found quite remarkable is Indiana Republican Representative Jim Banks tweeted out, and this is just mind-blowing to me, have we ever seen a president attack and malign the free press like Joe Biden has? And I'm going, hold on, wait a second. Was Rip Van Winkle here asleep during the 4 years that the former guy was there? Didn't he actually call Chuck Todd an SOB or threaten? I know. Memory is a bad thing to have. But when I threw it out there and I asked, you know, what kind of a fishbowl does this guy live in? to ask this question in an unironic way, and someone pointed out. And this is, you know, again, one of those things that you have to know the inside, that Tucker Carlson's son is actually the communications director for Jim Banks. Now, I am certain that, you know, that Bucky or Buckley or I'm sure Buckley is, you know, the smartest person. I'm sure he did it all on his own. I'm sure Buckley Carlson, his hiring in Jim Banks's office was purely meritorious. I'm certain about that, or maybe not. But as his communications director, I got to think that Jim Banks didn't write that. I got to think the apple didn't fall far from the tree in the propaganda front. And that's how we end up with such a stupid statement coming out of the congressman's office. And that, Congressman Banks, is a way that you can save face. Blame it on Tucker Carlson's kid. There you go. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown's going to be here to share some thoughts on Intel manufacturing and jobs. Back after this, stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day workers at the Kent Avenue power plant in New York City struck at Brooklyn Manhattan Transit. The power plant served as the sole source of electrical power for the entire New York City subway system. Transport Workers Local Union 100 had been trying to beat back the company's push to form a company union through an educational organizing drive there. Out of the 505 workers at the plant, only 35
5 were TWU members. On this day, two boiler room engineers with 10 years on the job each were fired for their union activity and given 3 minutes to leave the plant. Inspired by the Flint sit-down strike, then still in progress, TWU President Mike Quill called for a sit-down to protest the dismissals. 31 workers locked themselves in, and Quill announced that if the two fired workers were not reinstated by 6 a.m. the next morning, all switches would be pulled, shutting down the entire transit system. He insisted that the BMT had long abused its workforce and was in violation of the new Wagner Act. Newspaper headlines screamed of a workers' insurrection at the power plant, and the BMT quickly called in company goons to threaten the hundreds of picketers surrounding the plant. Workers stood their ground and prevented strike-breaking forces from breaking through the barricaded entrances. They organized food brigades and gained support even from the newspaper reporters who helped with food deliveries. By 5:30 a.m. the next morning, the BMT gave in to the demands of Quill and the TWU and reinstated the fired workers. Impressed by the victory of the job action, the power plant was fully organized within 2 days. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember on Friday we talked about Intel going to build a giant chip manufacturing plant in the middle of Ohio, somewhere near Columbus. New Albany, I guess, is the name of the town where they're going to build this massive. And look, we need it. We desperately needed this. But on Friday, the president had the Intel head and a number of senators and representatives talking about this new $20 billion plant. And Senator Sherrod Brown, he tweeted out, "Today we're finally burying the term Rust Belt." And I hope that's true, because as a kid growing up in Cleveland, I remember all of those manufacturing jobs. I remember when the mills were going and the factories were moving and all of the middle class jobs, the middle class union jobs that the men and women of that city had. And I remember it going away. The hope is that we rebuild that prosperous working class. And here to share some thoughts on, are we really burying the term Rust Belt? I've asked Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown to come talk with us. Senator, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to. Looking forward to it.
So I'm looking at this, you know, this Rust Belt term. Are we going to rebuild the Midwest? Are we going to rebuild that manufacturing prowess? Are we going to allow Trenton to keep the bridge that says America makes, the world takes?
Well, we're going to, yeah, absolutely. And it's not just, you know, I objected to the term Rust Belt years ago, and have told ad nauseum reporters, at least ask them to stop using it, because our manufacturing processes are no longer traditionally what they were. I mean, we're never going to bring back the hundreds of thousands, millions of jobs in the state, blue-collar jobs that paid a middle class, or at least a wage approaching middle class. And I grew up walking the halls at Johnny Appleseed Junior High and Mansfield Senior High School in Mansfield, an hour south of Cleveland. I grew up with kids whose dads, mostly dads, sometimes moms, were auto workers at Fisher Body, steel workers at Empire Detroit, rubber workers at Mansfield, tire machinists at Ohio Brass. Their parents were building tradespeople that worked in those plants and did the kind of, retooling of the plants and built the plants and all that. So we're not ever going to have quite that again. But with this, we've also seen far too many young people leave our state. And one of the exciting things about Intel coming in is, first of all, 5,000 jobs that are in for 10 years building trades jobs. They have promised me they're going to all be union, and I'm going to watch them and make sure of that. Then there's going to be thousands of jobs in manufacturing for as long as manufacturing jobs go, I don't know, a decade, two decades, 3 decades, 4 decades. I mean, Intel's got plants in other states that have been there 30 and 40 years. So I'm optimistic that way. And we're going to see more young people want to stay in the state. These are going to be good paying jobs. We've seen manufacturing jobs not just decrease, we've seen the wages flatten or worse. And my goal, and more than anything, is get people's wages higher, because we've seen executive compensation skyrocket. We've seen stock prices go up, and wages, as you know, Rick, have stayed flat. So that's kind of where I start on all this.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to see finally a manufacturing plant being built here. And look, nobody thinks we're going to go back to the old days. We're not getting the manufacturing jobs that have already been lost. We're not getting them back. But how about not losing the future jobs? And these, I think the pandemic has pointed out, we really need to start thinking about strategic investments in manufacturing, things that are going to strengthen our supply chains, strengthen our national security, and this being the first part of it, because we're now seeing people who can't buy cars, can't get the things that we need because, well, the smart chips that make our smartphones smart and our smart cars smart, we don't have enough of them.
Yeah, we know. And we were... as recently as, I believe, 1990, the U.S. made 30% of the chips of the semiconductors that were made in the world were made in the United States. That number is 9 now, went from 30% to 9%, mostly East Asia, mostly China. Taiwan is the leader, and South Korea. But a lot of things we should be doing. We're not. So it's preserving what we have. And we understand. I mean, you I know you know this because we've talked. It was government at the behest of very effective corporations lobbying Congress to pass NAFTA, to pass PNTR with China, to give essentially tax breaks to move overseas. So we saw these companies that you talk about in Garfield Heights or Cleveland or the West Side of Lorraine. We saw those plants shut down and move to China or move to Mexico because of bad government policy, lobbied by corporate interests. So first of all, we write that, and that's one of the things about the supply chain that's the most aggravating. The reason the supply chain is so hard to fix is it's stranded all over the world because we have seen so many of these companies move overseas. If they were all in the United States or mostly here, it'd be much easier to fix this supply chain. We made somebody told me that with Intel, we made 8 million fewer cars last year than projected. And I think we were projecting 18 or 19 million. So, and that was entirely, almost entirely because of the chip shortage. And inflation in auto sales is one third of all the inflation is in autos. So if that had not fallen apart, this problem of inflation would be much more manageable than it is now.
Yeah, but ultimately, for me, it's about, you know, something I've been talking about for years, you know, all during the push for NAFTA, all during the push for these free trade agreements, of if you decentralize our manufacturing prowess, if you do away with our ability to produce the things we need in times of crisis, we're not going to have them. And this played out during the pandemic, which, again, is why I'm thrilled that Joe Biden is finally, you know, taking that to heart and to mind and moving forward on it. One of the things that is concerning to me is I was reading some Ohio media on Friday and over the weekend where, you know, people were doing backflips to give credit to the Republican governor in Ohio and to the legislature and to the economic development slush fund that they've got. Almost no mention of the fact that this is an admission, this is a policy that this administration is moving forward on to reshore manufacturing and the billions of dollars that are going to be put in to bringing some of this stuff here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the other side of that coin, number one, Biden is really leading on this. The other side of that coin is the failure of Ohio state government for two decades to stop the bleeding. I mean, we're a state. I mean, we know about the corruption in this state. It's not just First Energy, the Speaker of the House, getting a $60 million bribe. It's also the governor appointing these First Energy executives in different jobs. It's the it was ECOT and the CoinGate and all the other corruption. And this government has under, as a result, state government has, you know, people pay higher utility bills as a result of this corruption. People see their schools underfunded as a result of this corruption. They see public health unprepared for the opioid crisis or for, obviously, for the pandemic. So, the state government has failed this state for a quarter of a century. And now they're taking laps because of the attraction of one company that President Biden and the Department of Commerce helped on significantly.
Yeah, but here's my question. I'm looking at, I'm remembering back during the former guy's administration, we had the big to-do about Foxconn and, you know, the billions of dollars that were going to be handed off to Foxconn to create jobs, and none of it happened. There are a couple of people there, but it never came to fruition. Are we concerned that this is possibly going to follow that, or do we feel better about this deal?
Foxconn never had the credibility. First of all, it's not an American company with a storied past. Second, it didn't have nearly the seriousness. I mean, I'm not an expert at Foxconn. I watched it, but I wasn't as intricately involved as I am in this. Second, you didn't really have, you had a Wisconsin governor that was kind of a flim-flam man, and you never had the focus in the gravitas that this one does. The CEO was there, his reputation's on the line for this. I don't think there is a possibility it won't be $100 billion. It'll be $20 billion instead of $100 billion investment. It's up to us to make sure that 20 turns into the 100 that he said he would like it to. But that really is up to the state and local communities, and it's up to all of us performing. And I'm optimistic about it. And I think this is going to be a change, and it's going to change it's going to change a lot of manufacturing now, because it's not just their investment, as you know, Rick, it's the other companies that feed into this. And because of the technology, I think you're going to see a lot more young people come to Ohio, and a lot higher percentage of our young people want to stay here and not get jobs necessarily at Intel, of course, but get jobs at ancillary businesses or just a different environment in the state. And one of the things we're doing to kind of help fix this is, and we started this 7 or 8 years ago, we set up these manufacturing camps. We've done about 100 of them now. They're a camp that kids from 8th grade to 10th grade, I think it's, or maybe it's fifth to ninth grade, I'm sorry, kids that are going and spending a day at different manufacturing plants in their community, but 10 or 12 kids in each camp, really kind of getting a taste of what manufacturing could be. And I think we're going to see a resurgence because of that. They might want to be a welder. They might want to be an engineer. They might want to work a line in a plant after seeing what it can actually do when they make stuff.
Yeah, we most certainly need to invest heavily in vocational education and getting people who are capable of taking raw materials and actually turning them into something. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown talking about the Intel deal, $20 billion semiconductor manufacturing facility they're going to be building in Ohio over the next couple of years. Here's the thing, Senator. You know, I keep coming back to our trade policies, and we do need to have some kind of you know, overall industrial policy. If you look at what China's done, they put it out in paper. You got the China 2025 plan. They want to take over all of the high-tech stuff, robotics, aviation, pharmaceuticals. They're saying it, and they're investing heavily in it. I see us trying, and I'm thrilled with the administration for moving this, but we need to have the full legislation and a full-on, full-court press on this. Is there something being done to move us in that direction?
Well, there certainly was this year, and we have, frankly, one senator. Well, part of that, Rick, is to, if you remember 4 years ago, we thought we were on the precipice of doing a trillion and a half dollar infrastructure package. And then President Trump changed his mind and did a huge tax cut that went to where literally 70% of the tax cut went to the richest 1%. So included in that was a sort of a get out of jail free card for companies, or that's not really the way to say it, more of a 50% off coupon for companies to move overseas. So we've got to fix our tax policy. We have one Democratic senator that stood in the way of that. She had voted against the Trump tax cuts. Now, for whatever reason, she thinks they aren't that bad. So to do this right, we've got to scale back and repeal a number of his tax policies that send jobs overseas. So we are, in a big way, this is the first president that's really been in the right place on trade issues in my lifetime. And Biden really is doing the right things on trade. We also have to do the right things on tax policy to make the U.S. the most attractive place to do business for an American company and maybe a foreign company wanting to come here.
Yeah, but also we've got to tighten up our trade policies. You know, I'm a big fan of the tariffs. I know I took a lot of heat from my liberal friends when Trump put the tariffs in place. I had been calling for those for a long time. We also need to track down people who are trying to avoid those by going through third party countries to avoid them. We've got to put our foot down and be a lot more, you know, enforcing of our rules. I mean, if you're going to play in the game, you got to play by the rules.
Yeah, that's right. And we've got, I mean, some of those selective tariff policies work. I wrote a whole book about trade called The Myths of Free Trade. And I led the opposition among the kind of the freshman class in 1993, my first year in the Senate, to NAFTA, and then led the opposition overall to the PNTR with China. I mean, I know what these trade agreements have done. I'd never voted for a trade agreement in my whole career at that point. And I know we have a U.S. trade rep now that actually understands American manufacturing and understands our national interest. And fundamentally, trade policy should be a policy derived sort of through the eyes, putting workers at the center. If trade policy is about workers, you don't pass stupid trade agreements. These trade policies about helping corporations move overseas, save money, sell their products back into the United States, avoid environmental regulations, undermine worker safety for workers. And so we know what to do now, and we're starting to do that now. We've got to fix the tax policy too.
Yeah, last line of questioning I've got for you. We're seeing an awful lot of investment going on, especially in Ohio, Michigan. Michigan, you know, what, a $7 billion $7 billion at General Motors is saying they're going to invest in 4 facilities there. And a lot of it centers around getting these chips to those manufacturers. But I keep coming back to, I want to make sure that those are good union jobs. I know in the infrastructure bill, prevailing wage laws were still in place. Is there a way to say, hey, if we're investing federal money in rebuilding and reshoring manufacturing, is there a way to make sure that those jobs in building, even in the private sector, these facilities, that those are union jobs as well? Is there a way to do that?
Yeah. Yep. Well, first of all, you start with this, that we have in this infrastructure bill, and Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin, I wrote these provisions. In this infrastructure bill, no more Bay Bridges in Northern California made with Chinese steel. I mean, if you're gonna get tax dollars, you're gonna hire American workers. And with that is an intensive campaign to make sure these are union jobs. When I was talking to Intel, when they came to town, east of Columbus, and we were in Newark at the time, when I was talking to them the other day, I said to them, you know, I said, I'm watching, these need to be union jobs. And the building trades leading up to the 10 years of 5,000 building trades jobs in manufacturing. And we're going to keep watching them, make sure these are union jobs. Our country, I mean, I know what union jobs did with my town growing up. It gave a whole lot of families real security, real family security and wages and benefits. And even in the schedule that you keep, you have some control over it. So we keep fighting for that. And any of these new manufacturers, we're doing everything we can.
Yeah, I tell the story all the time. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and the people that I saw get better and do better got those union jobs at the Ford plant on Brook Park or the Chevy plant or one of those feeder plants that fed into those where they had good wages and good benefits. You know, little things like food at the end of the month, little things like a secondhand bike for kids, and eventually move out of the projects altogether. So for me, the idea of union job, better life, inculcated in my mind from childhood. And I want to make sure that other workers have that opportunity. But Senator, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great talking with you. I hope you'll come back again real soon.
We will. Good deal. Thanks, Rick.
Appreciate your time. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any of the program, make sure you download the podcast. Get the podcast. Share it with your friends. TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1787. That was the day known as Shays' Rebellion. The United States was a new nation, and the Constitution had not yet been written. The Revolutionary Army had won the war with Britain, but the young nation was mired in debt. During the aftermath of the war, more farmers moved into western Massachusetts. Many of them incurred high levels of debt in setting up their farms. Due to economic hard times, the farmers found it difficult to repay their debts. Local sheriffs began to seize farms and even jailed some farmers. Anger amongst the farmers began to rise. They held meetings to discuss how to respond. Many saw the government's actions as an echo of the very type of tyranny they had stood up against during the Revolutionary War. They petitioned Boston for economic relief, but their requests fell on deaf ears. The farmers began to protest the courts, disrupting the proceedings. For 6 months, the farmers waged organized resistance. One of the men whose farm was threatened for repossession was Daniel Shays. Shays was a former captain in the Continental Army who had fought against the British. He organized a force of 1,000 men. The men marched on the debtors' court in Springfield and the arsenal located there. The governor of Massachusetts called out armed troops in response. These troops were funded by wealthy merchants from the eastern part of the state. And so, on this day, four of Shays' men were killed as the troops attempted to forcibly remove the rebels. By February, the rebellion had been crushed. The rebellion influenced the writing of the U.S. Constitution, as some drafters were convinced that a strong central government was needed to quell further uprisings by the working class. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'll tell you, I'm thrilled to see that we're seeing some increase in manufacturing starts here. I'm thrilled to see that some of this stuff might be coming back. Ultimately, again, I keep coming back to the reality. This is because of Joe Biden and the policies that we're moving forward to reshore manufacturing and take advantage of this moment of the crisis. Of highlighting the fact that we're too dependent on the rest of the world for the things that we need, and it's time we start bringing stuff home. It's great. It's great that we're seeing, you know, the EVs in Michigan, the chips in Ohio, the batteries in Kentucky and Tennessee, and all of the stuff that's going on. But remember, you know, for all the nonsense that we keep hearing about, oh, it's the Republican, it's Joe Biden in this administration. And here to share some thoughts on, what kind of a policy should we be moving forward? How do we get to the place where I think we all want to be, which is domestic production, domestic consumption? I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you.
So, you know, just had a nice conversation with Senator Brown from Ohio. Great news coming out of his state that we're going to finally start making some chips here. And I think, you know, highlighting the fact that a big portion of our inflation problems come from the fact that we're not manufacturing enough stuff at home, which is why we're having these problems. And I think the senator pointed it out accurately. A big part of our inflation has to do with the fact that we can't get the cars that that people want to buy. So supply and demand has those prices going way up.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, things like, you know, energy and food, they tend to fluctuate. And you know, the sometimes they're up, sometimes they're down. One thing that we've counted on for a long time is just kind of stable prices in the automotive sector. And that's been completely disrupted because of the supply chain shocks that we've seen. And the fact that, you know, pre-pandemic, you know, people had a different mix of spending than they do now. They used to spend more on services. Now they're spending more on goods. And that's awesome, you know, for manufacturing workers who are producing those goods. But it also can mean some shortages, particularly if you're dependent on supply chain that's overseas. So the Intel announcement in Ohio is fantastic. I mean, these are well-paying jobs. This is high-tech manufacturing. And Rick, I just want to take a moment here because I'm sure you feel this way too. And I almost want to, you know, do this to all the people over the last 30 years who said manufacturing jobs, they're gone, they're never going to come back. And they might have been right about, you know, the nostalgic manufacturing jobs from the 50s or the 60s, but they're dead wrong about this. And you mentioned this. It's policy. I mean, if you have intention, if you have policy, you can add manufacturing jobs. That's how countries around the world do it. And it's kind of built in to comparative advantage. So, the sooner we kind of come to grips with that, the faster we'll be playing the game and perfecting it. And so this is the cusp of what's possible in the United States of America. In electric vehicles, in batteries, in semiconductors, I think that we can have a bright future if we sustain some of that good industrial policy that can be the underpinnings of change and well-paying jobs.
Yeah, you know, and again, policy got us into this mess. Hopefully smart policy can help us get out of it, but it's going to be painful. I mean, one of the things that I'm not thrilled about, and I'll be honest, I'm not thrilled that we're giving billions of dollars to these companies to bring things back here. I'm not thrilled that we're using resources that we could be using for education and healthcare and other things to reward the people who abandoned us. But we're in a moment where we don't have much of a choice. If we want to claw these jobs back, if we want to be the masters of our own destiny, this is kind of the price of admission, I think.
Yeah. I think that's a really, really important point to make. And I'm not opposed to incentives as long as you have sticks or punitive measures as well for offshoring to kind of balance that out so that you are incentivizing good behavior and you're deterring bad behavior. And I think this is also important. And we heard Senator Brown say this, is that, you know, if we can make these jobs at Intel, at GM, at others, good jobs, the investment comes back to all of us because you have thousands of workers who are contributing into our tax system and contributing into our economy where we can recoup some of that investment that we're making. But the thing that, you know, juxtapose that to what Trump did and the Wisconsin, you know, Republican governor did, with Foxconn in Southeast Wisconsin, and what a boondoggle that was, and how there's so little accountability. And so I do think that it's important to bird dog these companies as we move ahead with these investments.
Now, for me, this is in looking at this transition, especially in the auto industry. This is one of those moments where I'm hoping we take the high road. Now, in every time we've had advancements from the beginning of time, the Industrial Revolution, the tech revolution, all of this stuff, the old entrenched industries ended up basically just getting gutted, and the workers in those industries ended up being just thrown to the curb and suffered the brunt of it. And we've seen this through, you know, every time a job left the country, they never got a job making what they were making with the benefits and the conditions that they had. This to me is that just could be that just transition from, you know, making the gasoline engine motor cars to making these new electric vehicles and seeing how this goes. I mean, this is where policy is important, I think, in seeing how what they're calling a just transition would look like. Mm-hmm. So to me, this is kind of more than just, hey, we've created some jobs, we're bringing some manufacturing back. This could be a blueprint in how we move forward in all of the things that we're going to need to do as we handle climate change.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you're making a very important point here, is that achieving these climate goals are existentially important. However, it's going to be difficult to do that if you don't have public support. And you're not going to have public support if you think that it's going to cause a lot of widespread job loss in the United States, particularly if other countries aren't doing their fair share as well. And so having a policy to ensure the transition is one that is job positive or at least job neutral in the United States, and that is creating well-paying jobs and opportunities for people who will need a transition, I think is very important. I look at the GM investment, Rick, that was announced on electric vehicles in Michigan, which is awesome because, first of all, it's in Michigan. So the UAW will have an opportunity to organize those facilities. And as the GM executive stated, this is going to help retain 1,000 jobs and create 4,000 new ones. And so we shouldn't pretend that, you know, everywhere that they're making a combustion engine right now, that plant's going to be there in 10 years. I mean, there's a strong likelihood that there will be a shift. But how you do that is important. And so if you're putting that electric vehicle or that battery plant in, you know, in Lansing, where you had that engine plant, for instance, then I think you're getting to that just transition. And we can make this a positive thing. And so this is where all these other policies are very important, Rick, because it's like, how much market share do we have globally and in the United States? And if we are both expanding the pie and we're getting a bigger piece of the pie, we'll be able to add jobs. I mean, it's not a secret. The problem was we were getting a smaller piece of the pie because of our competitiveness, our trade policies, and the industrial policies of governments like China over the last 30 years. And so we can make our piece of pie bigger, and better and tastier with the right industrial policy.
And it comes back to that, the right policies. And I sound investment, smart policy, those are things I think are really important. And you hit the nail on the head. There are going to be people who are going to be transitioned out of these jobs. They're going to lose their jobs. And how we treat them as they lose those jobs, I think, is going to dictate the whole rest of everything else that we have to do. Because a lot of the reticence, a lot of the fear comes from, well, you know, I'm going to, coal miners in West Virginia, they're going, I'm going to lose the only thing that I have to support my family. You're going to take this from me. I'm going to be working for $9 an hour at the biscuit factory and with no benefits and no future. And we can't survive on that. But if they see in practice what happens to an industry and there is a just transition, I think people might be a little bit more willing. And the reason I'm focusing on this is in the Build Back Better plan, there was that little bit of incentive to buy union-made electric vehicles in the U.S. And to me, this wasn't just about punishing Tesla. This was about encouraging people to get their workers to allow them to unionize. But it's about that transition and the auto industry that we have now and moving that in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a big piece of it, to make sure that we're adding well-paying job opportunities and that we're not encouraging a race to the bottom. That's not only going to mean some job loss, but also downward pressure on wages as we move ahead, because we've seen how that's turned out. We had a couple of decades of that, and it was devastating for industrial communities across the country. Coupled with other policies that are going to create demand. And I heard some economists call this the new supply side, but in a good way, where you have the public sector that is helping spur some demand in EVs, in other types of high-tech applications, where you can build out really lengthy supply chains, for charging stations and for electric, and for the batteries and for the production of the vehicles themselves, and then in the clean energy sector as well. These are complex machines, and they're going to need a lot of different suppliers upstream and downstream, and that will be more jobs. And so if we do have a focus on that, and this involves policy, I mean, the Senate passed a big competitiveness bill, wasn't perfect, but it was a step in the right direction last summer, and one was just introduced by House Democrats today, which is, I think, is great news that will mean investments in research and development, investments in the semiconductor sector, investments in skills training for those transitions, Rick, and other sorts of mechanisms that we have to try to leverage public policy to spur private sector investment. And we've seen the fruits of that. I mean, it's worth noting, this Intel announcement was not a one-off. I mean, we've seen semiconductor announcements in Texas, in Arizona. We've seen electric vehicle and battery announcements in the South, in Tennessee and Kentucky, in Georgia, as well as in Michigan and other states. And so this is not just a single thing like Foxconn that Trump kind of blew up to make this really big deal when it wasn't. This is a trend, I dare say, and we can build on it. If we put these permanent policies into place that are going to drive more investment back to the United States.
Listen to the Rick Smith Show with Scott Paul. Scott Paul is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. AmericanManufacturing.org is their website. You want to check out the work that they do. And looking at this, and the reality, I want to see that policy that's going to encourage government procurement to buy the next generation of things. It's how things used to be done until the last 30 years. The government had been a driver in a lot of technological gains. You know, we used to invest up to the possibility of technology until we went and we privatized virtually every bit of the commons. And now it's about making profit off of the commons instead of providing the best, most recent technology. And I'm hoping, and maybe I'm just too optimistic, which is weird because I'm usually never that optimistic, but I think out of this crisis, there's an opportunity to undo some of the failings of the last 40 years and maybe rediscover some of the great things that came out of the New Deal and the idea of government making lives better.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, and it's interesting, even the rhetoric on the business side has changed. I'm not sure that the practice has changed, but the rhetoric has changed where there's this claim that there's this newfound belief or rediscovery in stakeholder capitalism as opposed to just shareholder capitalism. Because, you know, the last three or four decades, it was just offshoring, mergers and acquisitions, stock buybacks, using the innovations that we had were financial innovations to screw some people and make a few very wealthy. And so if we can direct investment incentives, tax policy to saying, if you invest in your workers, if you invest in your U.S. facilities, if you're deploying that technology in the United States, you're going to get a big benefit. You're going to get a big benefit. We're going to make sure of that. If you move that overseas, you're going to get punished, basically. And I think that is the policy that we need, not only for electric vehicles, not only for clean energy and semiconductors, but more broadly, if we have that in manufacturing, we've got a bright future. I mean, before the pandemic and starting in 2010, we had added like 1.2 million manufacturing jobs in this country. And granted, we had lost a lot before that, but we added those jobs and there were robots and there was automation, there was competition. So we know we can do this. And so imagine if we actually have policies with intent, with purpose that are effective, we can blow the lid off of this and we can spur a new manufacturing renaissance in the United States. I mean, we added 350,000 manufacturing jobs last year, and that was before a lot of these policies came online with infrastructure investment, with Build Back Better, with training, skills training, and with a good clean energy policy and EV policy and procurement by America. We can get this done.
Yeah, no, I mean, all of this stuff should be done. And I love the fact that this administration has an office of Buy American. I love the fact that they are moving in government procurement to make sure that we source things at home and then, you know, use that power and that, you know, that bully pulpit to kind of make sure that the private sector does it as well. That we then yeah. Create the jobs that we need and not just the Intel plant, but all the ones around it and all of the ancillary industries that come off of it. We need to have that kind of entrepreneurial explosion again, what we've given away over the last 30 years. And I'm excited about the opportunity. So last question I've got for you. How do we, like 30 seconds, how do we push them to do the right stuff?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we do have this America Competes legislation that we got to get through the House of Representatives, and we have to make sure that it's good, and we get that passed and signed into law. So that's number one. Number two, we got to continue to work on Buy America, and I'm encouraged by the administration. I think they're doing the right thing. They've done it for a year. We got more to come.
Good stuff. Scott Paul, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you, my friend.
All right. Same to you, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Good stuff. Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Got any questions, comments? Love to hear it. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
After an election, have you ever found yourself scratching your head, wondering why it seems that working people vote for candidates who don't represent their interests? Well, that feeling's nothing new. Back in 1912, Ernest Rebbe of the Industrial Workers of the World created the comic strip character Mr. Block. Mr. Block was drawn with a head that was a big square wooden block. In the comics, he often sides with management against his fellow workers. Mr. Block clings to the notion that if he just works hard enough and plays by the rules, he too can have a slice of the American dream of wealth and power. Yet time and again, his dreams are dashed. For example, in one comic strip, Mr. Block gets laid off from work. In other strips, Mr. Block gets harassed by the police, cheated out of wages, and hurt on the job. Yet through it all, Mr. Block often sticks with management. We might all know some modern-day Mr. Blocks. So, on this day in labor history, the year was 1913, and wobbly organizer and songwriter Joe Hill wrote a song just for them.
Please give me your attention, I'll introduce to you a man that is a credit to our red, white, and blue. His head is made of lumber and solid as a rock. He is a common worker and his name is Mr. Block. And Block, he thinks he may be president someday. Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake, you make me ache. Go tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. I may do that for liberty's sake. Yes, Mr. Block is lucky, found a job by G. The shark got $7.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.